when you go to an art museum, are you giving your brain a workout? Art historian Jonathan Feinberg thinks so. He says that looking at pieces by artists like Jean Dubuffet or Joan Miró can develop your brain, and that perhaps art itself has helped humans become more creative. He writes about this in a new book called Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain, and he joins us now. Jonathan, welcome to Here and Now. And of course, full disclosure, we've known each other for a long time, and you've written about topics like this in past books, how the creativity of children's artwork has influenced some of the great artists of our time. But in this book, you ask why we make art, which is something we've done for thousands of years. What did you find?
Well, you know, I've loved images since I was a child, and I think I've made a whole career of trying to figure out why they have such a hold on me. And, you know, as you say, if you look at the cave paintings in the south of France at Chauvet, they're 30,000 years old, and that's 10 times longer than we've had written language. So if we're still doing it after 30,000 years, we probably need it for some reason, and I think we need it to complete the wiring of the brain.
To complete the wiring of the brain, that if we look at art, especially art that we don't understand, it may sort of rewire our brain and make us think of things in a different way.
Absolutely. I'll give you an evolutionary argument. It goes something like this. You know, if in nature you need to see what's in front of you or you're going to get eaten by a predator. And the truth is that probably less than 20% of what we see actually comes from the eye. Most of it comes from processing, intrinsic processing in the brain and the visual cortex, and it comes from memories and reason and emotion and all kinds of other things. So there's an inherently very creative act, and you're constantly revising what you think you see. And so if you don't have that creative capacity and you don't develop that creative capacity to be agile, you're at survival risk, I think. And I think that's something that art does for us that's very important.
It makes us more creative.
Yes.
Of course, there's no way at this point to scientifically test this argument and see if, in fact, we get more creative when we look at a piece of art that we don't understand.
Right. Science does not have the ability right now to look at the anatomy of a thought. But, you know, if you look at the most complex products of the brain, you can extrapolate the function of the brain. And in my view, somebody like Dubuffet, and I picked this particular work called Fluence, or fluidity as he in English, a painting that is so complicated there is no way to resolve it when you look at it. And it forces your brain to constantly try and fail. And the capacity to be able to try and put pieces together, to go to different parts of your brain, you know, when you look at, if you look at an fMRI of somebody looking at a work of art, you'll of course see the visual processing centers light up. But there's all kinds of other places in the brain that light up that people often thought of as just noise. But of course, it's not noise. It's the brain searching all over the place to try and figure out, what have I seen before that looks like this? How could these pieces go together? What is it I'm seeing? It's an evolutionary thing that's happening there. And, you know, I think that we can look at a work of art and we can learn a tremendous amount about how the brain works, how things are sequenced and structured that we can't really see directly.
Is that true both for abstract art and art that is very representative of what it's supposed to be?
Well, of course, what we think of as representative art is on a flat surface, so it's pretty abstract too when you really think about it. We're just making more conventional assumptions about representational images.
You're taking a 3D object and turning it into a 2D object.
Yes. All of it is abstract. But it is as true, certainly, for things that we tend to think of and call abstract as it is for things that we call representation. And that was the first chapter of this book is dedicated to making that argument. You know, I've been lucky that I've known some of the great artists of my time, and I've known them well enough to see how they work. And in that case, I took the example of Robert Motherwell, who was a good friend, and I knew him well enough that I could actually show in some of the recurring abstract forms what they represented in a very specific way, and that was an important discovery for me.
But you also quote Christo and Jean-Claude, famous artists who, among other things, did this incredible piece where they wrapped these islands in Miami in pink, what is it, canvas?
Well, no, it's a fabric they actually engineered so that it would float. It's a polypropylene.
Okay, so they did that. And you quote them here saying, "Our art has absolutely no purpose except to be a work of art. We do not give messages."
Right. great art has a kind of disorganizing character to it. Christo and Jean-Claude, of course, are not neuroscientists. They don't talk in the way that I would talk about these kinds of things. But, you know, when you fall in love with somebody, you have to accept somebody else into your way of organizing your world. And it can be a little frightening at the same time as being exhilarating. And a great work of art functions that way. If you really have a deep encounter with a great work of art, it's disorganizing. And you have to allow yourself to experience that in order to really grow with the work. So for Christo and Jean-Claude, they don't have a political agenda in a very specific way, but what they do is they open up your consciousness so that everything around you looks like you never saw it before.
Hmm.
Great works of art really cause us to rethink who we are.
We're speaking with art historian Jonathan Feinberg, whose new book is called Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain. And all of the images that we're talking about, we'll post them at hereandnow.org so you can follow along. And Jonathan, what about somebody who's listening to this who says, you know, when I go into a museum, it doesn't speak to me. I look at the art and maybe if I see something I recognize, it makes sense. But if I see something I don't recognize, I don't understand how that's even art.
Well, the clue is probably to go in and just pick out one thing that you're attracted to and take the time to really look at it. Don't try and look at everything in the museum. Pick one or two things you really want to look at. And when you spend the time and really allow yourself to try and figure out, you know, what kinds of feelings it's bringing up in you, you have a better chance of really getting to the core of what it's about.
Well, one of the images that you bring up in this book is this. It's very funny. It's a dog. It's an Alexander Calder dog with a clothespin that is part of it. That's the head of the dog.
Right.
What does that do to you?
Well, let me tell you a funny story about that. You know, that particular image, Calder and Miro were very close friends for most of their creative lives, and they had no common language. You know, Calder's French wasn't very good, and, you know, he didn't speak Spanish. Miro didn't speak English. And they communicated with their materials over a period of about 40 years and were very close. And when Miro walked into, when Miro for the first time saw Calder's work, he saw work like that little dog with the clothespin. And he came home and said privately, you know, that's not art. And, but he liked it. He didn't know what to make of it. And when Calder went into Miro's studio for the first time, he saw that work that's also in the book called The Spanish Dancer, which consists of a plain blank board with a hat pin stuck through a feather and a cork. And he goes home and he says, I don't think that's art.
Huh.
Well, what's really interesting about that is they both pushed each other to the edge of what the definition of art was. And of course, the art is what we think it is. It's all, you know, it's the definition of everything that we consider to be art, and of course, that's always changing and expanding. And for them, they had a really powerful exchange over pushing each other through their materials and through their form to a place where they both got uncomfortable, and then they began to work with it.
So what does that dog mean to you?
Well, the dog is funny on one hand. I mean, it's great to change a clothespin into a dog's head. It's just a funny transposition, right? And it's also very simple. You look at it, and it's just simple objects and a wire cutter and a pliers. He made that out of nothing. And so in one way, it seems so direct. But you begin to look at it carefully, and you begin to realize how complicated it is to have made that transposition of those elements to see them in a different way. And that's what a lot of great artists are able to do, is they take you to something that you already know, and all of a sudden you see it in a way you never saw it before. You know, Picasso will do this with a fork. It suddenly becomes a bird's foot, you know, and you just you would never have seen it that way. But once you see it his way, you never again are able to erase that. Your vision has been expanded by his ability to show you another way to look at something.
You write, without letting go of control, we can't innovate. We must continually revise our patterns of thought to be creative or even to see what really exists in this world. And I wonder, as we talk all about innovation right now and that if this is going to be the crux of the American economy and this is going to be what we need, what made you write this book and look into this question of what art does to our ability to think creatively and to innovate?
Well, I mean, that's what made me do it. It is, I think it's terribly important. We're having a big debate now about testing in schools. It's not about how much information you've gathered. We can go to the internet now and look up just about anything.
Yeah.
You need to be able to use your brain. You need to be able to think, and you need to put the pieces together in a different way. That creativity is what has made, given America its protean strength for the last century. And you look at, you know, what's going on in China, for example. You know, I get Chinese students who are very bright, really gifted people, but they've been trained in a system in which they learn to imitate, not to think. And the result is they really don't come up with the kind of creativity that my American students will come up with, even if the American students are in some ways technically less proficient.
Huh.
It's a very interesting thing to watch, and you realize how terribly important it is for all of us to be able to adapt and rethink and look at what's around us and put it together in different ways. That's what we have to do to survive.
That's art historian Jonathan Feinberg, whose new book is called Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.